I came out of the bog and the mountain of East Cavan. The beauty of the landscape is a perpetual invigoration.
Poet and playwright Tom McIntyre was born in Ballyburgh, County Cavan. His parents were both teachers. From an early age, he developed an acute awareness of the linguistic mix in his native county.
The language available then, I was born in 1931, so we're talking the language available to a child growing up in the 30s and into the early 40s, was quite a quite extraordinary mix of late medieval Elizabethan Scots and a throbbing, eloquent, plangent undertow of the recently lost Gaeilge.
Growing up in Cavan in the 30s and 40s, McIntyre was exposed to a traditional literary style of theatre, plays brought by the fit-up companies of the Carrickfords and Annie McMaster.
A play was people standing on a stage talking non-stop for an hour and a half, two or three acts. Grand. But at a certain point, out of reading, mostly, and a look at maybe modern dance, modern cinema, I got hooked on the notion that there can be a great deal more to theatre than just talk. You can play with the poetry of gesture, the poetry of movement, the poetry of the visual in a variety of ways.
McIntyre's travels to New York, London and Poland in the 1970s brought him in contact with the avant-garde in cinema, theatre and dance. But he found a primal choreography closer to home.
My essential introduction to the magic of the choreographic was in The Fair Day of Ballyburgh, one wet Monday about 1941. For the child, you were looking at a quite extraordinary theatre there every month of indescribable energy and gesture and magic.
The Bullring in Ballyburgh with its cast of characters suddenly became centre stage.
To be a playwright, given the seething theatre constantly going on around you, was quite an easy jump.
All these experiences coalesced into a first play, I Winker, Tom Tinker.
I guess around 1972, I wrote my first play and Tomás Mac Conagh was in charge in the Abbey and was extremely welcoming. I Winker, Tom Tinker, about James Stephens, the Fenian leader, and stylistically about as disgracefully conventional as you could get. Some critic, if memory serves me right, said, quote, you'd imagine watching I Winker, Tom Tinker, that Tom McIntyre has no notion whatever of what's been going on in the modern theatre since about 1900. Blushing and cringing from that comment, I decided to educate myself and read up, down and across Meyerhold and Appia and Gordon Craig and Grotowski and Peter Brook and the whole bunch. This would be in the early 70s. And I came in Meyerhold on a valuable piece of advice. He said, "If you want to write plays, okay. For a start, write a play with no words." And I said, "Oh, marvellous." So I wrote a play with no words called Jack Be Nimble. And the Abbey put it on. That was a decisive break for me with the conventional theatre. A play without words, short play. But to get it staged and have the fun of partial success was great. The piece after that, again, I was moving away from the conventional naturalistic. This is a Salome John the Baptist play called Find the Lady, about 1977, as I recall. And again, great fun. You can't go wrong with sex and death. There is no other story.
Jack Be Nimble was a piece that kind of arose out of a summer school that I did at the Abbey at the invitation of Tomás Mac Conagh, who was then artistic director in the mid-70s.
Patrick Mason directed both Find the Lady and Jack Be Nimble.
Tomás said, we have this mime play, we have this strange scenario from Tom McIntyre, would you take a look at it? We had a very good group of young people, including Stephen Brennan and Ingrid Craigie, who were doing a lot of movement. And so we said, fine, let's try it with the group. And in fact, we did it in that year's theatre festival as a late night. You know, it was one of those very happy occasions where a lot of talents came together. And McIntyre was, you know, already pushing out the boat into the kind of pure movement and gesture and exploring kind of areas of theatre vocabulary that obviously became far more developed in the later work. It was a sort of, I suppose it was like a marker. It was, and it was a kind of confluence of talents which, looking to the later work, we had sort of identified certain talents, certain people, certain ways of working, and Tom and I got on extremely well over it. And I suppose, you know, that really helped shape the future.
It's a long story.
Actor Tom Hickey.
It might be too long, Sean. Anyway, the nub of the matter is that I was at a play in the Focus one night, 82, I think it was, 1982. And I was in Hurricane's pub afterwards, and this gentleman approached me with the script. His name was Tom McIntyre. Now, I'd heard about him, and I'd heard about the sort of theatre he was interested in, which was strange and unusual. So Mary Elizabeth Burke Kennedy had told me about him. So he asked me, would I be interested in playing in a play about Paddy Kavanagh? I think that's the way he put it, in the festival that year. And I said, no, I can't, because I'm doing a play by Neil Donnelly, The Silver Dollar Boys. And I didn't see him. Now, I was on a sort of an annual contract in the Abbey with Joe Dowling at the time. He was the artistic director. But anyway, this in 1983, I believe it was, I went in at the beginning of the year, and he said, I have a play here about The Great Hunger, Paddy Kavanagh's poem. I said, is it by Tom McIntyre? Yes, he says, and I want you to play Paddy Maguire. So there it was again. So that's how I came to be involved. Patrick Mason was already designated as the director because he had worked with Tom earlier on short plays in The Peacock.
In The Matter of Great Hunger, a running debate in Irish theatre during the 60s and during the 70s was, how in the name of God could one get this great long poem, a major event in Irish literature? How could you get that onto a stage? I was unconsciously educating myself towards an answer to that question. I think maybe I had an intuition, obvious enough in hindsight, that the way to answering the question that was afflicting many was to make it a quasi-dance piece. All the rummaging I'd been doing in London and New York, particularly in New York, dance and the zone of theatre where the choreographic was a powerful element, was leading me towards a resolution to the question. But I can remember well the moment when the question was enchantingly resolved for me. I was in a museum in Boston, I think it was the Isabella Gardner Museum in Boston. This would be the late 70s, perhaps 79, 80. I find myself looking up at a drawing of men and women making hay. Something exploded in my head, and I said, now I know I can do it. I know the way to put The Great Hunger on stage.
I had trained as an actor at the Abbey Theatre School for 2 years prior to going to Paris, and Patrick Mason had taken over the theatre school in the second year. And Patrick knew that I'd been to Paris and knew my background in physical theatre and mime. And he asked me would I become involved in a production of The Great Hunger by Tom McIntyre.
Actor and mime, Vincent O'Neill.
And I think what McIntyre introduced, which was completely new for a country with such an incredible verbal Shanachie tradition, if you will, was what I can only call the theatre of the image. People had done physical theatre before, and I'd done a lot of Berkoff on that, but this was new in terms of blending the imagery, the physical imagery that came from the text. I think that was really the beginning of this theatre of the image. I'm not sure what McIntyre himself calls it, but I've always called it theatre of the image.
For the way the script looked and the way the published script looks today, A great deal of choreographic directions. I made a decision in reference to the language to use exclusively the language of the poem without interpolations. That was an easy choice to make because to carry the piece, you need incantatory language. Let us suppose you're getting the imagistic end of the proceedings right and you're getting the choreographic end of the proceedings right. And that takes a while, I can assure you. And I think it took us about 5 years to get it really humming. You must have a verbal score that can match that electricity. And you cannot have a verbal score to match that electricity unless you have incantatory language.
Well, the first production of The Great Hunger was in 1983 in The Peacock. And in 1984, we did a play called The Bearded Lady by McIntyre, which was about Dean Swift and his relationship with Stella and Vanessa. It was very demanding in a different way to The Great Hunger, because in The Great Hunger, McIntyre had used words from the great poem as his text in a way. Now, this was his own text, and it was in a way more complicated and indeed more demanding because we didn't have, say, the guide of the original work to assist us. So we had to create this, as it were, totally from scratch. And I thought it worked extremely well. Again, the basis of it was the theatre of the image rather than the theatre of the word, although there was more words in The Bearded Lady than there had been in The Great Hunger. Then in 85, we did Rise Up, Lovely Sweeney, which was based on Sweeney in the Trees, the old legend, which was a very, very strange piece, confounded many people, but a lot of the people who liked it said it should have been revived.
What you can do, I think, though, is detect two strands of work. One is works like Hunger, Bearded Lady, which was based on the life of Jonathan Swift and Stella and Vanessa, and Rise Up, Lovely Sweeney, which actually, next to The Hunger, is my absolute all-time favourite, which were all rising up out of extant material and were connecting into both historical and literary sources and then also bringing those into contact with sort of contemporary experience. And then you had other pieces like Snow White, Dance for Your Daddy, which weren't rooted in that kind of material, which were very personal, as it were, subjective to Tom McIntyre. Were his original writings more lyrical, all focused on the sort of intimacies of male-female dynamics within relationships, father-daughter, then sort of mother-son, then, you know, lovers, whatever, the dynamics of family and personal relationships. And I always think of those as carrying a kind of more lyrical, lighter kind of atmosphere. So they couldn't have their dark moments, but the idiom was more playful, slightly, I suppose, more kind of knowing and ironic. Whereas the other pieces, Bearded Lady and Rise Up, Lovely Sweeney, particularly Rise Up, Lovely Sweeney, they felt kind of connected into a kind of chthonic, a kind of earth energy. They were earthed in some way through their connection to history, to literature, to a darker kind of energy.
They upset people, those plays of McIntyre's in the 80s, because they were trying to understand them with their heads and with their brains instead of just letting them wash over them. It was more for the gut than for the head. And people used to get very frustrated. And we used to have these discussions after the previews of these plays. And McIntyre and Tom McIntyre and Patrick Mason used to take some horrendous flack from the audience about what these plays were actually about. I remember Patrick saying at one stage to a very disgruntled audience member, he said, "I know you don't understand it," Patrick said, "but do you recognise it?" And I remember another gentleman standing up and saying to McIntyre, he said, "I know you of old," he said, "and you're up to the same old tricks again."
The Mason, Hickey, McIntyre triumvirate. Really, the basic comment to make in reference to that is it happens or it doesn't. And there's no explanation. By the same token, it ends and there's no explanation. Except maybe, well, I'd say McIntyre ran out of gas. That'd be one way of putting it. But it happens unforecastably and vanishes unforecastably. And it's wonderful while it lasts. And it lasted 5, 6, 7 years, perhaps. So you run out of gas. Writers call it writer's block. There's no satisfactory term for it. But if you're the writer in question, you know glumly the depletion of energy. I think with that, when that happens, you have to examine, not to stress the obvious, your interior weather and find the nature of the wall before you and painstakingly set about dismantling that wall. Implicit in that is a theme dear to my heart. The writing that interests me is journey writing, a spirit journey on the part of the writer. All right, what is this spirit journey? It's easy to fling around these terms. Look, my bother with the Irish theatre is that it's hopelessly secular. I don't know that I've ever heard the word sacral mentioned in a discussion of Irish theatre, and I've been moving in and out of that world for 30 years. I was brought up in a world which said, oh, you want to be a storyteller, playwright, a poet? Fine. Haunt me, mister. Haunt me. You can't haunt without invoking the two worlds. Immediately you're into the zone of the transcendental. The only topics worthy of serious discussion are sex and death and the play of the two worlds across those questions.
McIntyre was the catalyst in the group in the sense that he came up with this very pared-down script where a lot of things fell back on improvisation and the creativity of the players and the imagination of the director. And it really was that cauldron, if you like, of the triumvirate of Mason and Hickey and McIntyre, with Hickey as the leading actor, Mason as the residing directorial genius, and McIntyre as the agent provocateur and catalyst in the mix.
So how do you get out? What do you do about the wall in front of you? Self-examination? What's your bother? What's your problem? Some go to an analyst. I did. It was a considerable help. But mostly I was on my own. So I did. I had no great difficulty in finding the field on the slope of the mountain where my bother was. And the field where your bother is the field where the resolution of the bother is. Between jigs and reels, I found my way into a side of the field that was fecund again for me. And I found myself with sheep's milk on the boil on my hands. And the zone, the riches of Irish folklore around me. The theme of that piece couldn't have been other than it was. That's a play about inundation. That's a play about the simple couple in the wilds who are faced with the question that I was faced with. How do I get out of the tame, sterile in ways zone I've been trapped in and find the fecund, the magical again? The woman in the couple knows the answer. The answer is to tear up the script and step out into the dangerous world and start over. The male in the piece doesn't. So that's the problem that's been examined right in the heart of the play. I'm forever interested in the female inside me who's interested in making the next mad jump, while the conservative male inside me is freckened out of his wits.
I had probably the best entrance any actor could hope for, because the walls of this cottage where this couple lived shake and crack open and I walk in. So it was a pretty dramatic entrance.
Alwyn Fuair, who played the Inspector of Rack in the 1984 Abbey production of Sheep's Milk on the Boil.
I also had a fantastic costume. I had a sort of fur-like coat, and underneath it I had a very, there was one point where I had this fantastic red silk dress. Every aspect of my costume represented some aspect of heightened female sexuality. All the fantasies you've ever had about playing all the female icons over the years that you've seen in the movies, you know. But the Inspector of Rack comes into this cottage through the wall, as I said, and her male counterpart appears at more or less the same time. They're kind of archetypal figures, male-female opposition figures, but they're also there to create chaos and to throw this whole order upside down and to unleash all the repressed aspects of this domestic situation. So various things happen where the two characters, Matt and Biddy, are presented with these decoys or challenges or temptations. So ultimately what happens through this chaos is that their domestic natural order is invaded by archetypal energies. And the Inspector of Rack is very much the embodiment of female energy in all its aspects, particularly the trickster aspect.
Setting aside for a moment the fact that I was brought up on the Mick Collins Dev Willibaloo, I'd have to write about Collins because he was such a lover boy.
Good Evening, Mr. Collins, directed by Cathy McArdle, opened at the Peacock Theatre in October 1995.
And he adored women and pursued women ceaselessly. And women clearly adored him. And in my reading, his failure to resolve what we'll call the woman problem with Collins, who had much on his mind, like founding the modern Irish state and running an astonishing counterintelligence war. While all that is going on, he has his interior life to deal with. This guy is a sensitive man and he loves women. And great, that's wonderful. Now, just as for you and me, the male, we're talking the male here, if you love women, you're going to have to decide sooner or later to move from what we call the provisional life to a commitment. Collins scarcely understood the necessity for that. And I believe the furore created inside him with a variety of women on his lap, in his bed, dancing around him, most notably Kitty Kiernan, Moya Llewellyn Davies and Hazel Lavery. We are killed by, not by the assassin's bullet, in my view, we're killed by the unresolved problem within. There are those who say Collins, going to West Cork on that fateful journey, knew he was going to his death, wished it on himself. I share that view. So the searing heart of the play for me is the male desperately tussling with an unresolved problem that in that instance costs him his life.
Looking at the later work, I mean, particularly the Michael Collins play and Bridget Cleary, there is a great pleasure both in kind of recognising, if you like, Tom McIntyre's trademark touch, but also seeing him going into very different areas and the variations that he's playing, if you like, on recognisable themes. I mean, particularly, say, in Bridget Cleary, which I thought was a very fine piece indeed. And it's his capacity in both the Cleary piece and the Collins piece to constantly surprise you. I mean, the humour that he brings out, particularly in the Collins piece, this wryness, this kind of ironic humour. The way in which in Bridget Cleary he suddenly had simplified in an extraordinary way some of his more, I suppose, baroque areas of the intimate and the male-female dance. And hit a sort of a wonderfully kind of pure note in the piece. It was the final 10 minutes of Bridget Cleary were quite extraordinary, I thought. And there was a wonderful kind of limpid quality about the writing, and it was more written, it was more heavily verbal than the other plays, and you felt you could say, oh, well, you know, he's returning more to the word, and he's returning, but the way he uses words on stage is still unique, is still extraordinary, and I felt that was a wonderful kind of development, if you like, or just a sort of area that he'd gone into. He's a great man, you know, for following the material.
The chirp on I found the word in Tim Pat Coogan's Life of Dev. Chirp on is Irish English for a baby. The chirp on was ill-written and found its realization and recovery in The Gallant John Joe.
The Gallant John Joe, essentially the story is of a girl with one foot in adulthood trying to make her way to be an adult. She's open and struggling. Now, the father, of course, John Joe Cunhannon, doesn't understand what on earth is going on. He thinks she's just crazy. In fact, what she's doing, she's just struggling to put both feet into the adult world. Now, subsequent to the chirpon being on in The Peacock, I'd been very fond of John Joe Cunhannon. There were several what I would call arias, long speeches, which were wonderful in it. So I went to Tom and I said, look, would you think of doing me a one-man piece using these arias? And let's see what we get, which he did.
So, to McIntyre's intense relief, we come to Bridget Cleary, his most recent play, where the woman has the central position. McIntyre is the happiest man in the Ring of Ireland. We have Bridget Cleary of extraordinary courage in taking on the collective and insisting, I want to be the sensual being, the sexual being I am, and if you have other notions, then that's too bad for you. And she asserts herself quite wonderfully, it seems to me, from the evidence available, and fatally, because the collective, as the collective will do, says, hold on a minute, we can punish you, you know. And they kill her. That's a terrifying story. Alongside The Great Hunger, perhaps one of the great excitements for me in my life as a playwright. The legacy I'd wish for is a sense in readers out there in the future, or playgoers out there in the future, that this writer believed intransigently in the unconscious, that he believed in the, by the same token, in the transcendental, that he did not conceive of writing as anything other than a spirit journey, that he wrote under the direction of the powers, and if he didn't, his strong awareness was that he couldn't write a syllable.
The playwright in profile was Tom McIntyre. The contributors were Tom Hickey, Patrick Mason, Vincent O'Neill and Alwyn Fuair. The programme was compiled and presented by Sean Rocks, and the producer was Kevin Reynolds. Next week, the playwright in profile will be Billy Roach.